It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, as Kathleen Dunn bids farewell to the airwaves, WPR gets ready to welcome 1A to the lineup next week. We'll talk to host Joshua Johnson about the show and his goals for public radio.
First, President Donald Trump said that he would meet North Korean threats with, quote, fire and fury earlier this week. Today, he continued the stern warnings to North Korea.
If anything, maybe that statement wasn't tough enough. And we're backed by 100% by our military. We're backed by everybody. And we're backed by many other leaders. And I noticed that many senators and others today came out very much in favor of what I said. But if anything, that statement may not be tough enough.
There's been a back and forth from the president's team since those comments yesterday. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson seemed to dial down the risk of war, while advisor Sebastian Gorka said it was nonsensical for the Secretary of State to weigh in on military matters.
Which puts a serious question on the table. What would it take for the United States to attack North Korea? And if the U.S. were to attack first, would it still be considered an act of self-defense?
Terrence Roerig is a professor of national security affairs and director of the Asia-Pacific Studies Group at the Naval War College. His forthcoming book is called Japan, South Korea, and the United States Nuclear Umbrella. Terrence, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, I think the question a lot of people have right now is, how likely is it that this hostility and this war of words could turn into some kind of actual war?
I think it's very unlikely. I think that you are seeing a lot of posturing on both sides. Certainly military options are on the table, and you expect your military to be planning for those things. But I think the United States understands that military actions are very risky, very dangerous. Seoul is a relatively short distance away from the border, and you would be taking a great deal of chance if you decide to strike North Korea militarily. Now, of course, there certainly would be lines that if North Korea crossed with a major military operation, that would be a different story. But I don't think we have reached that point at this stage.
You don't think the United States would take any kind of preemptive attack on North Korea if the threats escalated to a point where we thought a North Korean attack might be imminent?
Well, and I think that's an important way to phrase this. If a North Korean attack is imminent, now you are talking about a preemptive strike, and that certainly could be on the table. But I think one of the things that is important to remember about North Korea is that regime is not suicidal. They are not going to use a nuclear weapon or attack the United States and start a war. That will certainly mean that they will that will lead to the end of the regime. This is a lot of posturing on North Korea's part. They have done this before. Certainly the level is higher than it has been in the past. But North Korea does not want to start a war with the United States. And so I think that getting to the notion of a preemptive strike where it was imminent, I think we are a long way from that. Now, if you talk about a preventive strike, that's a different story, and that's a different issue, which is a very has a whole different set of conditions to it.
What kind of conditions would apply there? I mean, North Korea has been testing longer and longer range missiles, now apparently can make a nuclear warhead small enough to put on one of those missiles. What kind of military operation would it take to, I guess, thwart that now that it already exists? Is it too late to do something like that?
Well, see, and that's another part of the problem. Not only is it risky because of how North Korea might respond and the dangers that that would put Seoul under as well as the rest of South Korea, but the ability to get at North Korea's nuclear program is really a very difficult military operation at this point. They have a lot of their facilities dispersed. Many of them are hard targets buried within mountainsides. And so you would have a very difficult time. Plus, I don't know that we necessarily know where everything is. And so you would have a very difficult time taking out all of these facilities. Plus, North Korea, again, has many missile and artillery sites that would be able to hit Seoul in response with conventional weapons. So you are, again, looking at a very dangerous situation, and you might not, you likely would not be able to even achieve your goal at this particular point.
We're talking to Terrence Roerig from the Naval War College about the latest news on the tension, rising tension, more so even than usual, between the U.S. and North Korea. We've been talking about military options on the table so far, Terrence. What about the diplomatic front, the U.S. and its allies, South Korea and Japan, China, of course, in the mix? What kind of things are you looking for when it comes to diplomacy?
Well, that is what everyone says is the preferred goal, because no one wants war on the Korean Peninsula. Diplomacy, though, is going to be difficult, because I think one of the interesting elements of this is the new South Korean government has reached out in a number of ways to North Korea, offered a number of different possibilities for talks. I think the North Koreans are determined to achieve a nuclear capability and then will be willing to come back to the negotiating table. But I'm not convinced that diplomacy is going to do it. However, I think it is absolutely crucial that we continue to try and that we establish some form of dialogue and communication with the North Koreans, because I think that in the end, North Korea is probably going to get a nuclear capability. They are not going to use it. They feel they probably need it to deter the United States and South Korea. But in the end, it is crises that concern me, because that is when leaders are under pressure, timelines are tight, information is short, and that's when leaders can make mistakes. I think North Korea can be deterred under normal circumstances. It is these kinds of crises that concern me the most.
What do you make of what we're seeing from the Trump administration, the fire and fury comments from the president yesterday, now saying that's maybe not going far enough? Mixed messages, it seems. I think it's fair to say, from his team. What are you looking at there?
Well, I think it is part of the administration's posturing. I think it is certainly, in my own personal view, a concern that the administration doesn't seem to have a consistent policy on this. But nonetheless, I think the president himself believes that some degree of rhetoric like this probably gets the North Koreans' attention and stirs the pot to some degree. But it is, again, I think, largely posturing to get the North Koreans' attention, to demonstrate that the United States is willing to take this issue more seriously, and perhaps to put more pressure on North Korea. But I think ultimately they will decide that military options are bad ideas.
I want to ask you about the role of China. You've written about how North Korea might place nuclear weapons. I think one suggestion you put out there was that they might want to have it near the Chinese border so that any outside attack, any American attack, would maybe provoke China as well. Talk about the role of China in all this.
Sure. I think that is U.S. North Korea-China relations are very complicated. I had mentioned in a piece that I think one of the North Koreans' sort of interesting elements to this is that they may have put some of their nuclear facilities close to the Chinese border, which may make the United States hesitate and South Korea hesitate in taking some of those facilities out. But I think beyond that, the China-North Korean relationship is very complicated. I think that while they have a formal alliance and they certainly have a history that goes together, I think the North Koreans do not trust the Chinese, fear that the Chinese would throw them under the bus in a heartbeat if they chose to do so. I think the Chinese view the North Koreans as an insolent bunch who do not heed China's advice, particularly on nuclear and ballistic missile matters. And so their relationship is strained. But in the end, China has some strategic interests in maintaining the North Korean regime. They don't want to see the North Korean regime collapse and the instability that that would bring. And so while China, I think, is willing to bring some degree of pressure on the North Koreans, I think there are limits to that. There may be a tipping point at some time in the future, but I'm not sure where that tipping point is and if we are close to that.
We'll leave it there for now. Terrence, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Terrence Roerig, Professor of National Security Affairs and Director of the Asia-Pacific Studies Group at the Naval War College. His forthcoming book is called Japan, South Korea, and the United States Nuclear Umbrella. He joined us for a look at the latest on the United States and North Korea.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
WPR welcomes a new show to the Ideas Network next week. 1A will begin airing Monday through Thursday from 1 to 3 p.m. Launched in January, the talk show is the successor to the long-running Diane Rehm Show.
1A dives into politics, technology, and pop culture. The show considers itself a mirror for America, aiming to help the country reflect on itself and ask what it wants to be.
Joshua Johnson is the host of 1A, and he also hosted a four-part series on race and identity called Truth Be Told that aired on the Ideas Network last year. Joshua, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. Appreciate it.
Well, you said that you see yourself kind of like Tony in West Side Story, who gets between a couple of rival gangs getting ready to have a rumble and says, kind of, hold up, everybody, let's make this fair. So how is being the host of 1A like that?
Well, the analogy to Tony in West Side Story kind of has to do with the way that he intervened in what the gangs had planned as this big rumble, this all-out, no-holds-barred fight. And because there was something that Tony loved that was involved, he intervened and told them, or suggested to them, that they replace the rumble with a fair fight, the best brawler from each gang to duke it out. I find that my job is a lot like that. My job on 1A is not to tell people, don't fight. Because there are certain things that are legitimately worth fighting, arguing, debating over. You know, democracy is not about preventing debate. It's about managing and really propelling debate in a way that's productive. Especially when there is something in the middle that you think is worth fighting for. I think that the state of our union, that our ability to keep these states united at a time when there is so much strife and disagreement and discord, is very important. So my responsibility is to help people find other more constructive ways to fight more fairly and to just help referee, not to prevent people from expressing what concerns them, but to do it in a way that hopefully is productive.
And another aspect of that, you've gotten to define 1A fresh right off the bat. And you've said that it's going to be like a national mirror. Can you tell us what you mean by that, by a national mirror?
Yeah, we want to be able to just hold the nation up to itself and let us see ourselves, you know, warts and all, beauty and all, and take a closer look at the things that we need to look at and sometimes don't really want to. I think one of the things that I came away from the 2016 election with was a real sense of worry about the way that we depict different voting blocks, for example, particularly the people who supported Donald Trump or who supported Hillary Clinton, and that we ended up caricaturing people or stereotyping them or oversimplifying. And I think a proper mirror provides real detail. It will provide you as much detail as you're willing to look at. I mean, look at your face in the mirror next time. You'll see your face, and then try zeroing in on just the center of your face, and then just on your nose, and then just on the tip of your nose. All that detail is there in the original image the first time you look, but the deeper you allow yourself to look, the more you'll see. So my job is not to drag people into a deep conversation. It's to offer it. And if you stick with us for the hour, if you stick with us for the program, you'll be able to see deeper and deeper and deeper. And hopefully the pace at which we do that and the way in which we do that will be palatable for people who are struggling with an issue but want to take part in it. And ultimately, that will give people the kind of detail they need to really understand what's going on.
Now, I want to ask you a couple questions about 1A as it relates to Wisconsin, and it's coming to Wisconsin. And 1A, it's a national show, but it is produced on the East Coast. What are you doing to be a show that's not just for D.C. and not just for the East Coast, but a show that reflects everybody, including people here in Wisconsin?
Well, folks in Wisconsin and anywhere are always welcome to share their ideas for the program. At any time, we will do regular, we call them call-outs, where we'll say, hey, we've we've got a program coming up on such and such a topic. We'd love to hear what you think. But you're always welcome to go to our website, which is the1a.org. Click on Ask 1A and just tell us what you think we should be talking about. So you don't have to be in D.C. to share your thoughts. You don't have to wait until we go on the air or comment during a show. Our door is really always open.
And like almost all institutions who are lucky enough to stick around long enough, public radio, it's adapting to changes. It's looking at a need to renew itself. What do you think is top at the to-do list for public radio? And I'm wondering if you feel like 1A is doing anything to help check anything off that list.
I think the number one thing public radio needs to do is grow aggressively. We need to go after new audiences and let them know what you're getting from other sources, the ones that make you crazy, the ones that you retweet and share on your Facebook page just because they make you crazy. It doesn't have to be that way. There is a whole institution that's been built for the last 46 years, including very foundationally in the state of Wisconsin, that is entirely devoted to being better than what you're used to. And I think the main thing we need to do is grow very aggressively. Make sure people know what it is that we're doing, why it is that we're preferable to the same old talking heads and talking points that many people are used to in other media. There are stations like Wisconsin Public Radio all over the country that are doing really good work, that have a really solid core of supporters. The problem, or the opportunity, is to get that core of supporters to help find more people who would benefit from what this station has if only they knew how it could serve them.
We're talking to Joshua Johnson right now, the host of 1A. It's going to be airing from 1 to 3 p.m. on the Ideas Network, Monday through Thursday, starting next week. I also heard that you're a big fan of Marvel, of graphic novels, and I'm curious.
I've been known to geek out from time to time.
Oh, you read my mind. I was going to say, are you going to give yourself permission on the air to geek out, to be a super fan?
Am I going to? You haven't been listening to the show.
Oh, we haven't carried it yet.
We're way past that. I have made more than a few Marvel, DC, Harry Potter, J.R.R. Tolkien references on our air. More than a few. I think I made a Harry Potter reference last week on the air.
Excellent.
During a conversation about Chief of Staff John Kelly. So that shows you the level of my geekery. Thank you very much. I think that my responsibility is to bring my authentic self to this show. I made a decision a long time ago that I can't make a career telling the truth about everyone else's life and lying about my own. I can't do that. Some people have to hide certain aspects of who they are for safety. I get that. But for me, I thought the more that I can be comfortable in my own skin, the more I can allow other people to be comfortable in theirs, because I know what it feels like to be disdained for being whatever. And I think public radio is at its best when it allows people to speak in their own voices, to not have to try to sound more smart or more erudite than they are, to not feel like they're not welcome here because I should have finished that master's degree, so I guess I'm not smart enough to listen. I think we're at our best when we just welcome people and say, come as you are. There's this amazing service. We built this for you, for the whole state of Wisconsin, and it's just for you, and you're finally here. Welcome. That's when we're at our best. So the geekery and the nerdery are just an extension for me of a more important core value of public media, which is letting people be who they are. I'm not going to pretend not to love the stuff I love, because I love it. And I'm either going to be honest about it as appropriate, or I'm going to suppress it and it's going to make me a basket case. And then I won't enjoy what I'm doing. And I don't think if that was the case, then this wouldn't be a job that I would have signed up for.
That would be a beautiful place to leave it, but I want to ask you one more question, my James Lipton Actor Studio question.
Oh.
What is your biggest
dream? I love
that
little questionnaire he does at the end. I love those 10 questions.
I do, too. It's always my favorite part.
What is your favorite word? I love that.
Oh. What is your... Well, no, we'll get to that maybe another time, but in this interview, I want to ask you, what is your biggest dream for what 1A could accomplish maybe a few years down the road?
My biggest dream? I always hesitate because I know that whatever I dream, there's something even bigger that we should be aiming for. But I will say one of the things that I want 1A and Wisconsin Public Radio and every public radio to start doing is stealing listeners from other stations. Mm. I want the rest of the business to know that we are a threat. I want everyone else who purveys news and information to know you're second rate, your time has come, your ticket's about to be punched. There are millions of Americans who deserve better, who deserve more insight, more context, more respect, more fair play than you have given them. And we have been building up to the day where we can cut your head off and take all your listeners from you. I am looking forward to the day when programs like 1A can be the cornerstone of a programming lineup, of a content array that is so irresistible that the whole nation knows this is our first choice for news and information. I mean, right now, NPR reaches about 30-some-odd million people a week, which is awesome. Unfortunately, it's also less than 10% of the U.S. population. There's a lot of room for us to grow. And my dream is that we as a program can help bring more people into this really important conversation to the point that other outlets recognize us as a threat. I want us to be a player. I want us to be the cornerstone of where America goes to make sense of itself, to be heard, to be validated, to be respected. I want everyone to know you need to raise your game. And if you want to know what that sounds like, tune in Wisconsin Public Radio. They're doing it 24/7.
I like the way you think. Joshua, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure, Veronica. Thank you.
That was Joshua Johnson, host of 1A. The program begins airing on the Ideas Network next week, Monday through Thursday from 1 to 3 p.m.
Coming up after the news, if you want to be happier at work, make it less of a priority in your life. That's the message from a philosopher after the news. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk to a co-author of the newly signed law in Wisconsin, the RAINS Act, which limits agencies' regulatory power.
First, if you're like a lot of people, work is a big part of your life. A lot of your day is spent on the job, and it takes up that mental, physical, and maybe even emotional energy.
Our next guest says, in a lot of cases, work takes up too much of our lives, not just in terms of time, but in the way it shapes our identity. And he says, we can be happier if we make sure that we care about other things more than we care about work.
Andrew Taggart joins us now. He's an author and practical philosopher with a PhD, by the way, from the UW-Madison. His piece on work is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Rob.
Well, in that piece, you start with the concept that we live in an age of total work. What does that mean?
Total work is a concept that comes out of the writings of a lesser-known German philosopher named Joseph Pieper. And he argues, as I see it, that more and more work is becoming the center around which the modern world turns, while everything else in life comes more and more to resemble work.
And you write about how some examples of this might be that we try to stay healthy and be fit so that we can be more productive, and a good day might be defined by being a productive day, and that this is getting into this whole work mentality that just kind of permeates everything.
That's right. So one thesis is that work has become central. And another thesis is that everything else in life has come to be subordinate to or subservient to work. And I think a nice example here, and you could read it in the New York Times, perhaps, or in the Wall Street Journal, would be to say something like this. Well, why would you meditate? And the answer provided would be, well, I'd meditate in order to be more mentally calm or healthier. And then someone would say, well, why would you want to be more mentally calm or healthier? And the answer would be, well, because I'd like to be more productive at work. If you want, you can play that game with a lot of different questions and come to some fairly similar answers, namely pointing to work as being the end, the reason why you would do that.
How do you see that affecting our happiness, that we focus not just on work while we're at work, but everything else keeps leading to this idea of being more productive?
I think so a little bit of context is in order. I didn't come to be fascinated by work for its own sake. I came to be fascinated by the nature and structure of the modern world, the world we live in. And over the last 6+ years, I've had a number of philosophical conversations with people around the world, from Silicon Valley to Scandinavia, from Central America to Middle America. And I was surprised that people had never met each other before. We're starting to sound more and more like one another. And what they continue to say, very roughly speaking, is that their ideas and notions about work were causing them needless suffering. And that became very puzzling to me about why that was so and what could be done about it.
So suffering, that's a strong statement, not just that we're not happy, but that we're suffering. Why is this obsession with work making us suffer?
Well, I think there are a few different reasons. One is that, I'm using it in a Buddhist key. So the word there is dukkha. And if we relax our use of the word suffering, we could come to a word such as unsatisfactoriness or restlessness or a feeling that things don't quite add up or a feeling of being stuck or a feeling as if I'm never quite done with things or through with things. That's the state that I'm trying to describe.
We're talking to practical philosopher Andrew Taggart about work and our lives and how work is taking over our lives in a lot of ways and even permeating our time away from work. We weigh our value and happiness by how productive we were, and he's hoping that we can start to change that. And Andrew, let's get into that a little bit. How can we make work a little bit less of a priority in our lives and start to focus on other things, maybe more fulfilling things?
That's a beautiful question. I think that there are a few different steps involved. The first is to think about the fact that we're human beings who care about things, and we care about things that we value or take to be important. So for reasons that would be very historical and might go beyond the bounds of our current discussion, we've come to take work to be extraordinarily important, extraordinarily crucial to or central to a life well lived. And so what I would first ask us to do is to begin to think about whether or not that's true. Is it really true that work is nearly as important as we think it is? And if we begin to look around at people who are very successful at work, we can begin to wonder whether their lives are as good as we thought they were, or whether there aren't actually things going on in their lives that would cause them some form of unsatisfactoriness, whether it's not being around their family, whether it's not being with friends, whether it's not being involved in religious celebrations, and so forth. Once we've begun to undertake serious questioning of the value and importance of work, then we can move on to some other steps. Namely, we can begin to think about things that would be perhaps more important than work and that would take us into art and, dare I say, philosophy or religion and spirituality. And we become involved in things that allow us to lose the sense of time around us and get lost in what it is that we're experiencing. And my proposal is that those kinds of experiences are the ones that I think are more enriching, more fulfilling, and above all, more meaningful.
Is that time sense a part of it? That it seems like when we're at work, we're basically on the clock. It's a metaphor, but it's also what happens in real life. We're watching the hours tick by. We're feeling crunched for time, that we're not going to get enough stuff done. So is losing sense of time and being maybe outside of time in a certain sense, is that important here?
It very much is. I think that if we were to treat time as if it were a literary figure, clock time rather, as a literary figure, then it would seem as if it were our enemy. That it's always against us. We're always behind it, and it's always pushing us onward. We're never really quite where we'd like to be. And so there are experiences that we've had, and no doubt we've all had them, in which that sense of clock time falls away. And we feel as if we lose track of clock time while we come to feel a kind of uplift or a sense that the world is beautiful and wondrous and even in some respects mysterious.
That's a hard instinct to fight, though, and we have the concept of wasting time, which in a way is a metaphor, but it can make it hard to, if you're doing something that doesn't get your work done or make the kitchen cleaner or whatever, it feels like you're frivolously wasting time. How do we start to overcome that sort of, I guess, psychological hurdle?
I think we need to imagine for a moment that the secular age has brought forth a few goods or a few ideas about what a good life is. And one is that work is central. And the other is that when we're not working, we would seek some form of pleasure. And so if we imagine that's a horizontal dimension or horizontal plane, we could then imagine ourselves looking up and seeing a vertical dimension or vertical plane. And the idea would be that, I think this is easiest, for example, for theists, for people who believe, they begin to actually see that their relationship with God is actually revealing to them that there are higher dimensions to reality, higher dimensions to life. So it wouldn't be the case that they would just not do the dishes or that they would cease the ordinary tasks of the day. It would rather be the case that they would just complete these tasks without getting hung up on them or caught up in them, so that they would have the non-clocked time ability to experience that vertical dimension to life. So my proposal is that we need to find some way of valuing something that is more than or above the ordinary calls and claims of work and pleasure.
You hear about the concept of flow and how when you are in flow, time is something you're not aware of. Hours can pass and it feels like minutes. If we're on the clock and it feels like a grind, does that maybe just mean that we're in the wrong line of work? If we were in a different line of work, we'd be in flow and it wouldn't necessarily feel like work.
That is a good question. And I've heard that often from people, namely that perhaps we just need to change lines of work. And without a doubt, some forms of work would be better, period, or better for me than other forms of work. And I don't think that's disputable. But what I wonder whether, what I often hear from people with whom I have conversations is that they've tried that before. They've continued to move from one line of work to another line of work to a third line of work, thinking that the answers to life lie in meaningful work. And what I'm suggesting is that perhaps there is more to the philosophical inquiry than just finding a better or more suitable line of work than the one we're presently in. Maybe our ill-at-easedness, if we were to only listen to it, would carry us farther out of the dimension of work and into something else.
We're talking to practical philosopher Andrew Taggart. He says we can be happier with our work lives if we make them less of a priority and with all the other stuff that's going on in our lives.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Does work take up a lot of your mental space, even maybe when you're off the clock? Do you take time in your life to do things that are non-productive? How do you define who you are? Does it involve work or not? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we continue our conversation about work and happiness with practical philosopher Andrew Taggart. He says we can be happier if we make work and productivity a less important part of our lives and define ourselves more by the non-work stuff that we do.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about your life here? Do you feel like you always need to be productive on and off the job? Does work dominate your day and your thinking? And how do you define yourself as a person? Is it what you do for a living, or is it something else? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Andrew, let's talk about that identity question, because you write that this ultimately comes down to who we are. I think a lot of us define ourselves in part by the work we do and conversation. We might ask, what do you do? I guess Americans do this more than other people in the world. So how do we answer that question of who we are when we start to separate it from work?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, we can think about how we could answer the question, who am I? And you might say, well, I'm so-and-so's husband or wife, or I came from a particular place, or I came from a particular people, or I'm someone who comes from a particular country. And I would suggest that what's been really fascinating from a historical point of view is that we've begun to think it's common sense to answer the who am I question in terms of what sort of worker we are, or to update the terminology, what kind of career we have, or where we are in that career. And I would suggest that that's only a very small part of the story. When we begin to ask the question, who am I? And philosophers ask that question, Zen Buddhists ask that question. The question, who am I, begins to cause us to doubt that we're just workers, that maybe there's more to us, more to what it is to be human, perhaps more than what it is to have an identity, than what can be exhausted by or understood in terms of work. And so we begin to ask that question, we can come to possibly higher and higher levels of awareness with regard to that question, provided that we continue to keep up asking it. It's not an easy path to take necessarily, but I do think it's a really beautiful and fruitful one to take.
I want to go to our callers now. We've got Brad with us first in Mequon. Brad, hello.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'd like to maybe offer a redefinition of productive. People say, well, did you do anything productive on your vacation? I said, yeah, what my wife and I did, we visited our family. It produced a lot of happiness, produced a lot of pleasure. We sat and watched the ocean, and that produced a lot of happiness. So productivity doesn't always have to be measured economically. And so I will say, yes, we were very productive, and we enjoyed watching the birds today.
So, I like that definition, Brad. Thanks a lot. What about redefining productivity, Andrew?
I'm happy with anything that, if we loosen the terms a bit, I'm happy with anything that brings us into leisure and play and festivity or celebration more often in our lives. So I'm very sympathetic to the idea that something that brings about joy in others would be, particularly in family members or in community members, is really a wonderful way to think about certain aspects of one's life.
Brad, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Dave in Cobb. Dave, hi.
Good afternoon to I'm kind of nearing retirement, and I'm wondering to myself, you hear about the guy who goes fishing every day, and after a while, a couple of years later, he passes away, you know. I was wondering, does he need to keep in touch with his fellow workers after retirement, or what would you suggest?
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. So in retirement, and I think this is a common problem, Andrew, if we've been defining ourselves by our work and our workplace, finding that meaning and finding an identity in the post-work world. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, it's a really wonderful thought. And I'm as sympathetic to that view because my father retired young. And he has told my wife now and again that he feels as if, in virtue of being unproductive or unuseful, that his life has no meaning. So it's a deeply relevant question today. What I would suggest is that part of the puzzle comes out of the fact that we're not really quite sure what words to use in virtue of the extent to which work has become total. So we think of things like hobbies or get-togethers, but I think we need a little bit thicker words in order to describe what it is we do and what we're about when we're with friends or community members. So I would suggest, for example, that being involved in charities would be one wonderful thing to do. I think that becoming a master of sorts at fishing, rather than just taking it as a simple hobby, is a beautiful way to take one's time with things. And I think too the reinvigoration of civil society, which we've largely lost, is a part of the answer. That is coming together in groups, in clubs of the sorts that my father grew up with when he was younger. So there are various ways of trying to build up a sense of friendship, of community, and of purpose that aren't necessarily tied specifically to work or to working.
And I love your list of suggestions that you can start with to take a first step to getting outside of time and thinking of life outside of work. One of them is lying down in a rowboat that's going nowhere, which sounds to me surprisingly appealing. I haven't done that. I think that came from a different source. Forest bathing is another one. What is it about those activities?
These are delightful activities that are, as Oscar Wilde would say, they're utterly useless. And I'm not using, I'm being a bit coy there, but I also mean it in earnest. To riff on Oscar Wilde. One example came from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and he tells us that in this piece he writes that he rows out in the boat, so he does exert himself a bit. He rows out in the boat to the middle of the lake, a peaceful lake, and then he lies down in the lake and allows the boat to drift around him. And I think this is but one experience, which is reminiscent of stargazing. It's reminiscent of the kind of letting ourselves be that can come as a consequence of some kind of exertion. And it's these sorts of experiences that are contemplative. In the Latin, they're the vita contemplativa. They allow us to contemplate our relationship with the universe. And it just happens to have the effect that it makes us feel very calm, often very much at ease with where we are.
And ultimately, you mentioned this earlier, you're hoping people can start to be more philosophical. You're hoping that we can start to think of who we are and, as you were just saying, how we relate to the universe. How can we start to adopt this attitude of what you do, practical philosophy in our lives?
Well, a philosopher might say that he wants everyone to be more philosophical, so we may wish to take that with a grain of salt. But if we set aside my own bias, I think that what speaks in favor of our philosophizing or of being more philosophical is that, quite frankly, in principle, we can all do it. That is, if we think of philosophy as an ongoing reflective activity concerned with asking and trying to answer more basic questions about human existence, about why we're here, about what it's all about, then I think at some point in our life, particularly if something bad has happened, it behooves us to ask that question. And what's wonderful about asking that question is that even if we don't come to an answer that's satisfactory or fully satisfactory, we come to a state of wonderment. And I think that that's a genuine state of wonderment. We really do feel the sense that something is awesome or wonderful. And that brings us far away from our cares, our anxieties, the noisiness and disturbances and busyness that otherwise seem to occupy almost the entirety of our lives.
Well, that's a good place to leave it. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
That was Andrew Taggart. He's an author and a practical philosopher. He has a PhD, by the way, from the UW-Madison, so we welcomed him back to Wisconsin today. We have a piece on that he wrote on work. It would appear on quartz.com. We've got a link to that over at the Central Time Facebook page. And you can share your thoughts while you're there. You're going to hit the rudderless rowboat this weekend?
It sounds really appealing. But one thing I have tried that he also mentioned we didn't talk about was a sensory deprivation tank. I got super stressed out a few months ago. And I tried this. And you know what? It's pretty great. And during this interview, I just kept thinking, I think I'm going to try that again.
I'm going to go back into the tank.
Yeah.
I worry about being alone with my thoughts to that extent and no sensory. But I think that idea of the forest or the boat might be a little safer. I don't know, like a little something to see and focus on outside of my head.
Worth a shot for sure. On a somewhat related note, today happens to be National Lazy Day. It's an invitation to take some time to do nothing.
And I guess we've already failed on that score by showing up at work. Our bosses appreciate it, though. But I think I can pencil in some lazy time for this evening, maybe.
That sounds nice. Or we could just throwing this out there.
Okay.
We could head out right now and skip the rest of the show.
Just brainstorming there.
Or we could install a hammock in our office.
Ooh.
And instead of getting ready for the show, we could lie in the hammock or the studio. We can conduct our interviews
and
from the hammock.
Make every day National Lazy Day here on Central Time. I think it might show up in how we perform on the show. In nothing but a good way.
I agree. I mean, if we've learned nothing from our interview with Andrew Taggart, it's that a hammock in the studio is a good idea.
Right. And we're going to get that Fry Daddy, too. So we're going to have deep-fried, state fair-style foods. I worry about our health at this point. If all we're doing is eating fried foods.
I don't know. We might be really relaxed.
And interviewing people. Share your thoughts on work and life and Lazy Day, National Lazy Day, over at the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Those days of soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Dust off the sun and moon and sing a song of cheer. Roll out those